This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Step inside and you and I will get briefed together on the big issues by people who know what they're talking about. And do please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. And if you'd like, please recommend us to anyone you can think of, really. If you enjoy this, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room. For example, you might want to listen to the special programme we did in conjunction with The Bottom Line about the future for Europe after Britain leaves the EU next year. This week, I'm getting briefed on trade wars. What are they? And can you win one? So take your seat in the briefing room. The banner headline from this morning's Financial Times reads, "Beijing's fighting talk over US trade war sends markets reeling." Some people don't think this is a bad thing.
When we're behind on every single country, trade wars aren't so bad. Do you understand what I mean by that? When we're down by 30 billion, 40 billion, 60 billion, 100 billion, the trade war hurts them, doesn't hurt us.
That was Donald Trump speaking last month after his administration had announced radical increases in import taxes on steel and aluminium. And this week, China, on some measures the world's second biggest economy, announced retaliation. So I want to know where this is going. What exactly is a trade war? And is it possible to win one? That's our mission here in the briefing room, if you'd like to step inside. First, here's the historian of world trade, Mark William Palin, with a short guide to the history of trade wars.
In 1927, George and Ira Gershwin put on a musical satire about trade wars called Strike Up the Band.
One and all, to the martial swing, strike up the band. There is work to be done, to be done. There's a war to be won, to be won. Come, you son of a gun, take your stand.
It's about an American cheesemaker who wants to corner the dairy market at home. He persuades the U.S. government to put a massive tariff on imported cheese. But when Switzerland objects to the tariff, the two countries end up going to war. For real this time.
Listen, I'm a peace-loving citizen, and I'm supposed to go over there and fight? For what? To make the world safe for Fletcher's cheese?
But it's the best in the world, Jim. You know it is.
The classic weapon of a trade war is the tariff. In other words, charging a tax on foreign things coming into your country. Now, tariffs aren't necessarily a sign of ill will. Back in the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th, taxing foreign goods was the main way governments raised revenue. There's a reason why Brits used to refer to smugglers as the free traders and set the revenue men to catch them. But tariffs can also be used to protect domestic industries from foreign competition. The logic is that if you whack a chunky enough tariff on a foreign product, it will discourage or even prohibit foreign companies from competing in your domestic market. Your domestic producers get a leg up because people will have little choice but to buy their stuff, just like the cheese in the Gershwin show. In theory, they can then charge more for their products, hire more workers, and pay them higher wages. Everybody's happy, like I said, in theory. It's this kind of tariff, the protective tariff, that can spark trade wars, as we've seen with the US and China this week. You slap a tariff on my products, and I'll slap one on yours, and so on. So where does it end? When we talk about the downside of tariffs, we usually think about things like high prices for consumers, businesses going bust because they can't sell their products abroad or import the things they need, and so on. But history shows us that the diplomatic fallout from tariff wars is also important. probably the most famous trade war in modern times was triggered by something called the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which the U.S. government passed in 1930. It put taxes on a whole swathe of imports, from grain to goldfish. America's old trading partners quickly responded in kind. So far, so expected. But the ripples went further. In Italy, for example, American-made cars were smashed up on streets, and soon no one wanted to buy them anymore. The Italian leader Mussolini fought back against the Smoot-Hawley tariffs by rushing into a trade deal with Soviet Russia, and the two countries sealed their friendship with a non-aggression pact 2 years later. After the Second World War, world leaders took the painful lessons of Smoot-Hawley to heart and put in motion a sweeping trade liberalization program that would become the World Trade Organization. And they did so, in no small part, to avoid another tariff war like that which rocked the 1930s. But tariffs aren't the only weapons you can deploy in a trade war. As trade became more formalized through the 20th century, countries found clever ways to give their homegrown products a boost.
In recent years, there have been technical developments which could transform the world of television and sweep away the traditional habits of people watching a schedule of programs over which they have no control to watching the program that suits them best. Besides video cassettes, we now have, or are about to have, video discs, teleprint, satellite, and interactive or two-way television.
In the 1980s, France was worried about the impact of imported video recorders from Japan. They came up with an ingenious solution. Force every video player entering France to be thoroughly inspected by a 9-man team of customs officials in the small city of Poitiers. The man in charge of this new Battle of Poitiers, as it was dubbed, proudly told the New York Times, "Before the new policy, it took a morning to clear a lorry load of video recorders. Now, it takes 2 to 3 months." You can see why it's tempting for politicians to get involved in a trade war. It's far easier to get your electorate wound up about jobs that have been lost to other countries than to identify those that have been created. And some economists argue that for developing countries, there can be benefits to keeping some of your trade in-house rather than relying on the tender mercies of a global marketplace. But if the history of trade wars teaches us one thing, it's that when things get heated between two countries, it's not long before others get sucked in. In the Gershwin's musical, just as war between the U.S. and Switzerland had ended and a peaceful League of Cheese established, an ultimatum comes in from Russia about caviar tariffs. And, it's implied, the whole thing starts again. So if you're hoping that the rest of the world will be able to just get a bag of popcorn and watch the U.S. and China taxing the hell out of each other, you should probably think again.
Mark William Palin. The omens appear bad. Yet Donald Trump believes strongly that the United States can emerge from all this strengthened. To find out what he's done so far and to what effect, I'm joined from Washington, D.C. by Chad Bown of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. What exactly has the United States administration done in the last couple of weeks when it comes to trade?
Well, the Trump administration has basically at this point decided on three different sets of tariffs to impose, and two of them have already been done. So back in January, it decided to impose a relatively straightforward set of import restrictions on solar panels and washing machines. That wasn't a big deal. It was a lot of trade, but it was kind of following the normal rules and procedures for how you implement tariffs. More recently, at the end of March, they finally imposed these really controversial set of import restrictions on steel and aluminum. These are very controversial because they're under a national security law. It's basically the Trump administration saying steel and aluminum imports are a threat to American national security, and so we need to stop them from coming in. This is the kind of justification for trade barriers that countries really never resort to. And it's been highly controversial with the international community, and the Trump administration has given some trading partners the ability to wiggle their way out of it by negotiating for exemptions. But other countries like China haven't been able to get out of it, and their response has been to retaliate.
Okay, so we've had the washing machines and solar panels, we've had the steel and aluminium, and then what more recently?
So the steel and aluminium was about $18 billion worth of trade. So that one, you know, that was a lot. But the really big one has just taken place. And so the Trump administration just this week followed through with releasing their product list of what turns out to be about $46 billion worth of imports from China that they're going to impose new 25% tariffs on. And here the story is, you know, out of all of their kind of controversial and non-standard approaches to trade policy, here there's probably an actual important underlying issue, right? So China isn't a market economy. There are concerns that it doesn't treat Western companies fairly. It forces them to locate their production locally, to transfer their crown jewels, their technology, their innovations to local Chinese companies if they want to be able to sell in their market. And so the United States has said, you know, well, that's enough. The Trump administration has said, unless you somehow stop doing that, we're going to impose new tariffs on you on $46 billion worth of your sales into our market.
Can I ask you just very quickly, how does it come about the president has such power that he doesn't have to ask Congress for agreement for anything in order to do this?
President Trump and his team have chosen to self-initiate trade cases under a variety of U.S. trade laws that grant incredible discretion to the president, to the executive branch of the American government, to be able to impose these kinds of tariffs. Under this national security law and under this special China case as well, this is a different law called Section 301. These laws exist. The Congress has, over the decades, granted the authority to the executive branch, to the president, to be able to use these kinds of laws in extreme circumstances. And President Trump has decided, well, you know, this is an extreme circumstance. And he really does have the power to do this kind of thing unilaterally without consulting Congress too much or the American people about whether they think this is a good idea.
So what kind of reaction has there been from Americans, from industrialists, from exporters and importers, and politically?
I think there's a lot of worry. I think we can see that happening in the uncertainty in stock markets. Some of it is perhaps more muted than one might have anticipated, and partly that is because President Trump is so unorthodox that one is never quite sure how much of his rhetoric he intends to follow through on and ultimately implement. And when it comes to trade policy, so far he's actually followed through with some of the really quite negative policies that he's proposed, the steel example, the aluminum example. With this case on China, it's so big and so potentially disruptive that some of the pushback that one might anticipate happening may be waiting and saying, we can't believe that he would actually do such a thing, that he would lead us down this path. But there may be others out there that think that what he's doing is engaging in some sort of negotiating tactic of bluff and bluster.
Is anyone applauding what he's doing, saying, yes, that's kind of what we need, and it's a proper defense of American interests?
Yeah, there are a number of folks who are applauding him. You listen to members of his cabinet, and they will repeat the same lines that President Trump is giving about how, you know, it's easy to win trade wars, and, oh, you know, the American economy is doing so great right now that, you know, don't worry about it. Things will be fine. But on the other hand, I think there are some folks across the United States that are becoming increasingly worried. I think especially in rural communities and agricultural communities like soybean farmers that are now concerned that his path of actually implementing these trade restrictions, provoking China, may have real severe and dire consequences, you know, for their livelihoods. They may be the ones caught up in this. They're not steel workers. They're not aluminum workers. They're not benefiting at all from, you know, these tariffs that President Trump might be imposing. They are actually going to be harmed by the fact that he's taken these actions.
Chad Bown. This week, the Chinese made their initial and almost immediate response. President Trump's $50 billion worth of tariffs was matched by $50 billion worth from China. But what is China's longer-term strategy? Dr. Jue Wong is an expert on the Chinese economy based at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands and an associate fellow on the Asia-Pacific program at Chatham House. Jue Wong, why did China decide to join the World Trade Organization back in 2001?
China wanted to join in the mid-1980s, 85, 86. China already wanted to join. However, the negotiation process took rather long, took a decade and a half, and China eventually joined in 2001. Also, when China started to realize it would do itself good to be more connected with the international trade markets and international economy in general, so that China could sell its products to the world, especially the labor-intensive goods, because of China's has a large amount of low-cost labor.
Now, how would you characterize the way in which trade relations have worked between China and other countries since it became a member of the World Trade Organization?
The general trend shows that China's trade volume has increased since 2001. China has developed a very rich trade relationship with all over the world, with the EU, with the US, with Asian neighbors, with Latin American countries, with African countries. China's trade with developing countries and emerging market economies also went up really fast after that. Since China joined WTO, it has had a large trade surplus in trade of goods with these countries.
Now, one of the criticisms that we've heard quite a lot is that China doesn't always compete fairly, that it does things in a sense to protect its industries, particularly domestically, from foreign competition, or that it is responsible for dumping cheap goods on the market. How does China respond to those criticisms?
That's a really good question, because that shows to you that not all countries stick to the same standard of fairness. So China obviously argue against some of these arguments. Right. So China's arguments is, first of all, China insists that it has lived up to the promises it made when it joined the WTO. It admits that maybe some promises it made back then are probably too light for today's China after another decade and a half of development. But China insists it has lived up to most of the promises it has made. China also thinks it is not fair for the U.S. to make Chinese companies keep buying high technology products and patents from the U.S. companies without letting these companies transfer the technology to the Chinese companies freely.
Now, the United States has recently raised tariffs on a range of products, famously in the course of the last couple of months. Could you tell us just factually how China has responded to those raised tariffs?
Okay. A few days ago, the U.S. Made a list saying they would raise a tariff on a number of high technology products, for example, medical devices, aircraft parts and batteries, flat screen televisions, etc. Mostly the products of the industries that lose benefits to China's policies. So China responded very fast to the U.S. announcement with the same amount of tariff on U.S. goods. So China also made a list to say they would increase the tariff on U.S. products such as aircraft parts, information technology products, telecommunication technology products, robotic technology products, transportation, medical device, etc. So it looks like it is a conflict in the trade war style. However, I would probably not define it a trade war until all these tariff increases are implemented.
So are you saying that you think there's a good chance that the tariff increases that have been announced won't actually be implemented by either side?
It's unclear. I wouldn't say it's more likely to be implemented or less likely to be implemented. But as far as I know, that the government officials from China and some industrial group leaders from the U.S. are still making effort to negotiate in order to avoid a real trade war from happening.
Where do you think, at a worst-case analysis, this could end up?
I don't think we will see a huge trade war happening that is so serious, severe, but last for a short time, that both the economy dramatically fall. I don't think that's the scene we are going to see, because once the tariff are added, both economy are going to see the damage from it. For example, obviously the U.S. customers and the U.S. producers will be hurt. And on China's side, for example, China has alternative suppliers of agriculture products. Okay, that's why some some Chinese analysts are so confident that if we don't buy soybean from the U.S., we can buy from others. However, you cannot switch supplies this fast. So what I'm saying is both sides are going to see the negative impacts of increased tariff, and they might get more moderate gradually.
Jue Wong, it would be interesting to be a fly on the wall in Downing Street this evening. In just under a year, the UK will embark on its first round of unilateral trade negotiations for more than 40 years. Both the United States and China are potentially important trade partners in the post-Brexit era. So how worried should the British government and other governments be about the burgeoning trade war? Dr. Meredith Crowley should know. She's an expert on trade policy and trade law at Cambridge University. Meredith Crowley, if I were the British Prime Minister looking at the tit-for-tat stuff this week between America and China, should I be worried?
So I think the number one direct worry that should affect the UK right now is when you look at the list of products China wants to restrict imports of from the United States. At the bottom of the list is airplanes. Now, the aerospace industry in the US is the largest in the world, but the second largest in the world is in the United Kingdom. And the UK firms supply US airplane manufacturers. So the big concern, I think, for the UK right now is what kind of ripple effects a tariff that China imposes on US airplanes would have backward through the supply chain all the way to UK firms here. The sector employs over 100,000 people directly, and ancillary industries that support that employ about another 100,000. So that should be number one on the list for the Prime Minister today.
What, if I'm the Prime Minister, I'm being advised, would I be told about the other implications of what's going on for Britain?
So I think a longer-term implication that is a concern has to do with how easily the UK can negotiate some type of future trade agreement with the United States. And what we've seen so far in the Trump administration's approach to negotiating trade agreements is that the president really doesn't see trade as a winning situation for the U.S., although in fact we see a lot of benefits from trade. And so the contentious negotiations the U.S. is engaged with Canada at the moment suggests that it could be very, very difficult for the UK to negotiate something productively with this administration. Now, this is surprising because if we had just about anyone else in the White House, either a Republican president or a Democrat president, both of those parties would see some value to deepening a trade relationship with the United Kingdom. An additional concern beyond that is that if you think about what the UK makes, they make a lot of sophisticated manufactured parts. And within North America, we have a North American free trade agreement between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. And the supply chains for the firms that make things along these three country set are really deeply integrated. So autos use parts from Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. And so if you're the U.K. and you want to export things to the U.S. in the future, you really want to be able to sell stuff to the U.S. that they can then send on into Canada. And so really, if you think about what should the UK be looking for as a big strategic objective post-Brexit, they might want to just join the North American Free Trade Agreement rather than going for this bilateral agreement with the US, which if they then say, okay, we have an auto part we want to sell, you don't want to have a US firm say, well, that's a nice part, but if we put it in our car, we won't be able to then send it on to Canada and sell it there. And that's a big part of our business model.
So far from a Trump presidency being what some people assumed, which was a good thing for a post-Brexit Britain, a Trump presidency is actually a difficult thing for a post-Brexit Britain.
I think it is a more difficult thing for post-Brexit Britain than if some other Republican candidate had been elected to the presidency or a Democrat.
Okay. Now, specifically on the US-China battle, what do you as an analyst think is going to happen next? Speaking to a Chinese expert, there's a sort of expectation that there will be a dialing back once the impacts of these tariffs become clear to constituencies both in China and in the United States, and that this thing will be settled. Is that your expectation?
That's certainly my hope. And I think the glimmer of hope comes from this trade war is proceeding in two stages. Stage one was about steel. And after the U.S. announced its tariffs and then China announced its retaliation, American businesses right at the start started to complain to the administration in the U.S. and say, we can't afford big increases in the price of steel if we want to make things like washing machines and automobiles. So this is going to be damaging to U.S. manufacturers and to the workers of those downstream industries, so the industries that use steel. So the consequence of that complaining was that the U.S. reduced the severity of those steel tariffs by basically saying we're not going to impose import tariffs on steel coming from Korea, the European Union, Canada. So they kind of stepped back a little bit there. And one thing we see in the report that came out of the U.S. government was they said, well, actually, here's the list of 1,300 products that we might no longer import from China or that we'll only import with a 25% tariff. But they're going to have a public hearing in May at which American consumers and American businesses can come forward and say, actually, we don't want a tariff on this product because this is something that either businesses need or consumers need. And so they're even showing the willingness to listen to that. I also think that the Chinese were very clever. You know, they said that they would put tariffs on soybeans. That's sort of the heart of Trump country. The American breadbasket of Iowa produces soybeans. They also announced tariffs on steel tubing. Steel tubing is manufactured in Texas, Arkansas, and Alabama, three other parts of the United States that are big supporters of President Trump. So once those workers and those companies see, oh, actually, this trade war doesn't look so good because now we're going to have trouble exporting what we manufacture to China, I think within the United States, different groups that are going to be affected negatively by the trade war are going to start speaking to the administration. The U.S. administration is then going to go forward and speak to China and say, well, actually, let's try to dial it back. So I think that that is the hope, and there's a good chance that that will happen, because if we go to a full-scale trade war, it will be very damaging to the United States, and it will almost inevitably result in the loss of jobs for U.S. workers.
Does that have a knock-on for the rest of the world?
It does, and it depends a little bit. The extent of the knock-on depends on the product. So as I was saying with steel, when the U.S. restricts imports from China, Chinese steel still goes onto the world market and then ends up in the European Union as cheaper steel prices. So that's good if you're a manufacturer who wants to use steel to, say, make a car in Germany, but it's not so great if you're a producer of steel in Germany. So there's winners and losers from these knock-on effects that go around the world.
In his speech announcing steel tariffs, President Trump suggested that there could be a trade war, but that was okay because trade wars can be won. Is it your opinion that that's true, that trade wars can be won?
No. So that's really just a really mistaken understanding of what international trade involves on the part of the president. So the reason why countries sign trade agreements, and the only reason why trade agreements last and persist, is because both parties to the agreement think that they're getting something out of it. So they both have to benefit. But with a trade war like this, there will be costs on both sides of the Pacific, and these will be harmful to both countries. So in that sense, it's really not winnable. And the concern right now is the way that the Trump administration is trying to solve the problem is like, let's shoot ourselves in the foot and hope that the Chinese decide that they'll play nicely tomorrow. So it's really not a good solution to a serious problem.
Meredith Crowley there with the last word, and my thanks to her, Mark William Palin, Chad Bown, and Jue Wong. We'll be back next week, subject as yet unknown. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Neil Koenig, Tim Mansell and Beth Sagar-Fenton. And please let us know what you think about this programme or indeed the entire series. And you can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We really love hearing from you.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.